Netanyahu on the phone and invited him to the United States. Not clear when or where.
Unfortunately, it's time to ask the United States, when will you turn from a hollow talkings and condemnations into deeds? I mean, for how long will this masquerade go on, in which the United States is not very happy about all kinds of things that Israel is doing, but does nothing, but nothing, to influence Israel to change its way? How long will taxpayers in the United States spend so much money over quite a well-off state whose social needs are very, very low, whose military is one of the strongest and well-equipped in the world, and doing all this without any kind of conditioned terms? Everything is given to Israel, and Israel can do whatever it wants without really any consideration of what the United States is asking. So one of the two, either the United States is not serious about it, which is my suspicion, or the United States really believes that by talkings and condemnations, Israel will change. This is also very disappointing, because after 55 years of occupation, of violating any resolution of the international community, by ignoring American policy toward the Palestinians, Israel continues to do whatever it wants. So if the United States didn't draw the lesson, it means that the United States is very happy about everything that Israel is doing. And the proof is that the United States does nothing to change it, including Obama's regime administration, and now Biden administration, which has, I'm sure, very good intentions. But this is not enough when it comes to Israel.
And finally, Haggai Matar, I'd like to ask you, how do you see this crisis potentially developing? What are the prospects for it being resolved? Do you think that the massive protests will prevent any further overhauls of the court?
I think the government is in trouble. It might not seem like that when they pass, you know, a bill 64-0, but I do think that they're in trouble. They've been limited from doing what they had initially set out to do, which is a full judicial overhaul. They've been basically prevented from doing that. And I think with this latest measure and the responses we're seeing from so many different parts of the Israeli economy and security systems, and the unions are now talking about potentially going on strike, and the demonstrators on the streets. And there's just so much going on that I don't think that what the government is doing is sustainable. They might take a pause now just to kind of reassess. They might try and push forward, and I think they will probably fail. And there's a chance that this government at some point will collapse and be replaced with a new one, very much like the previous one we had, the so-called government of change, which will put a stop to this whole judicial reform and move towards full authoritarianism. But at the same time, there's a serious risk that if that happens, there'll be a feeling of vindication, of a victory of democracy, whereas, in fact, Palestinians will continue paying the price under such a government as well. So I think we have to be very, very careful of either the scenario of this government continuing to doing what it wants, and of the scenario of this government falling and being replaced by another that is better for democracy for Jews, but just as bad for democracy for Palestinians.
And we just have 30 seconds, but Gideon Levy, just the news of the last hours that Israeli forces killed 3 Palestinian men in Nablus, 17 Palestinians were also arrested in an overnight raid. How aware is the Israeli population? I mean, we are seeing water cannons. We're seeing some of the methods the Israeli government uses in the West Bank applied to the protesters. But only some. I mean, when you see this level of killing of Palestinians just in the past year, talk about what is the awareness in Israel and what you think needs to be done about this.
That's maybe the core of the issue, the fact that Israeli society is living in total denial. The media is the best collaborator to supply this denial. And Israelis don't know anything, don't want to know anything about what's going on half an hour away from their homes. This killing of three Palestinians today is hardly covered. And if it's covered, it's covered in the most minimal way you can cover. I mean, a killing of a dog of the army is covered in bigger ways than killing three Palestinians, at least two of them innocent, as far as I understood. So this daily killing is going on. Israeli society couldn't care less. The occupation is not on the table anymore. And the only way to make it change is when Israelis will have to pay and to be punished for those crimes. As long as this doesn't happen, they can continue to protest against damage to their own democracy and ignore the fact that they are living in an apartheid state.
Gideon Levy, I want to thank you for being with us, columnist for Haaretz, member of its editorial board, the Israeli newspaper, and Hagai Matar, executive director of 972 Advancement of Citizen Journalism, publishes 972 magazine. When we come back, 19 attorneys general in the United States are demanding access to people's private medical records to evaluate whether someone had an abortion out of their states. We'll go to Kentucky to speak with Planned Parenthood. Stay with us.
Grown tired of being so careful about speaking my truth with soft words. Out on the streets, I'm fearful, even though inside I know my worth. But I'll never give up, even when turning over tables, and love still makes the blind that I see. There's a healing that's waiting in the water.
Good Trouble by Lee Nash and Ruby Amanfu. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to a shocking development in the rollback of abortion access in the United States. 19 Republican attorneys general are demanding the right for local governments in states where abortion is illegal to access the private medical records of patients in order to see if they obtained reproductive health care services, including abortions, out of state. The letter was signed by Daniel Cameron of Kentucky and Todd Rokita of Indiana, among others. And critics say it could intimidate patients from seeking legal health care elsewhere. Abortion is set to be banned in Indiana with limited exceptions starting August 1st. Meanwhile, more than a year after the reversal of Roe v. Wade, abortion providers report many Kentucky residents are crossing state lines to access abortion care due to the state's near-total abortion ban. To be clear, it's legal for anyone in the United States to access abortion care in a state where that care is legal. That comes after related news out of Tennessee, where the state attorney general's demanded Vanderbilt University Medical Center hand over medical records of patients at its clinic for gender-affirming care, a ban on surgical and non-surgical care that helps people transition toward their self-identified gender took effect in Tennessee. And meanwhile, in Nebraska, the teenager who used abortion pills to terminate her pregnancy was sentenced to 90 days in jail. Police charged 19-year-old Celeste Burgess and her mother, Jessica, who assisted her in getting the pills and disposing of the fetus after Facebook handed over their private messages to each other. Celeste was 17 when her mother got the pills online. The events took place before the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last year. At the time, abortion in Nebraska was banned after 20 weeks. Earlier this year, Governor Jim Pillen signed a 12-week ban into law. For more on all of this, we go to Louisville, Kentucky. And we're joined by Tamara Weider, Kentucky State Director for Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates. Welcome to Democracy Now! Why don't you begin with this first story of attorneys generals, Republican attorneys general, demanding medical care records of people who have gone to other states for abortion, and what exactly is happening in your state of Kentucky, Tamara?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. No, it's really troubling. Daniel Cameron, our attorney general in Kentucky, along with 18 other attorneys general, have demanded that states turn over medical records and entire medical records in states where abortion is legal to hostile states. And this is deeply troubling. This goes against HIPAA laws. You know, this is your private medical records being turned over to hostile attorneys general. What else are they going to do with this? It's likely that they are going to look for a case to prosecute either providers, patients, or those helping people cross state lines to where abortion is legal seeking care.
And Tamara, are they looking for blanket records, or are they wanting the right to look at individual records that they somehow suspect somebody may have violated the abortion bans?
You know, that's a good question. They are asking for medical records from people we believe that are from their state, but they're asking for the entire record. And that is what's deeply troubling. Right now, when somebody does have an abortion, there is a terminated pregnancy report, which gives just vital statistics that protects a person's private medical history and identity. That should be enough statistical information for the state to know how many people from, say, Kentucky are getting an abortion. We know from Indiana's recent reporting on abortion that over 90% of their out-of-state care for abortion in Indiana went to Kentuckians this last year. That should be enough information for Daniel Cameron, and that's, you know, across the country with the terminated pregnancy reports. But they're asking for your entire medical record, and that is going to be scrutinized. Every decision your doctor has made for you over your entire medical history is going to be scrutinized, and that is deeply troubling. And everybody across the country should be concerned and alarmed that, you know, your medical history, your choices, your provider's choices are up for grabs.
Has the Attorney General Daniel Cameron of Kentucky demanded this information from a Planned Parenthood clinic?
Not yet, to my knowledge, but that doesn't mean it won't happen in the future. And he is running for governor, so we hope that he does not seek that information. You know, right now, no, Planned Parenthood in Kentucky, of course, is providing abortion because we are under the ban.
And I wanted to ask you about what's happened in Nebraska, this astounding story of Facebook handing over the private communication between a mother and a 17-year-old daughter who was seeking an abortion. The mom got abortion pills for her daughter, and the daughter took these pills. Now both the mother and daughter, the daughter what faces, she's 19 now, 90 days in prison.
Yeah. No, it's deeply troubling that, you know, communication that we're having in, you know, times where we don't know what is legal, you know, in our communities around healthcare, if we're just asking questions, if we are seeking out healthcare advice, can be used against us. This information, be it text messages, Facebook messages, search histories, should not be turned against us as we are seeking healthcare. And people are scared. They are desperate. They need healthcare. And if you are asking questions, if you are searching for support, this should not be turned against anybody. But this is what happens when healthcare is politicized and it is criminalized. People, you know, become scared and desperate. Healthcare should be safe for people to search and demand, you know, respect from. You know, they should be able to get healthcare from their providers and, you know, talk to their parents about. They should not be criminalized for seeking support.
And to go back to a second to this request by these Republican attorney generals, you mentioned the HIPAA law. That's a federal law. Shouldn't any judge just throw this out of court, saying that federal law trumps any efforts by local states to access these records?
You know, I hope we'll find relief from the courts, but, you know, the courts have become more politicized, you know, in the last decade, you know, and so there is fear that as we go forward in, you know, relief, if they seek judicial if they seek the courts to uphold what they are seeking on these records, you know, we don't know what circuit they'll go for. Will they go to the judge in Texas, Kaczmarek? We don't know how this will play out. But one thing that I think is really important to focus on is this sets a really chilling precedent. This scares patients. This scares providers. I think that is a big, you know, component of this coordinated attack. It is to set a precedent of fear. If I leave my community, will I be arrested? Will my medical records be released? If I am a provider, will I be subpoenaed and arrested in Kentucky? Should I provide care to out-of-state patients from banned states? I think, you know, what this sets is a precedent of fear that's going to chill care.
I wanted to turn to a court in Austin, Texas last week, which heard testimony from women who are suing to overturn Texas abortion ban, which put their lives in danger when they were unable to end their pregnancies, even when they were non-viable. In a dramatic moment, plaintiff Samantha Cassiano vomited on the stand as she recounted how she was forced to carry out her pregnancy even after receiving a diagnosis of an encephaly, a severe congenital disorder that results in a baby being born without portions of its brain and skull. And this is another plaintiff, Elizabeth Weller.
I was sent home to wait for my baby to die or for my infection to start showing physical symptoms, even though they were already there. But I wasn't sick enough to get the care that I needed. There is no statement of pro-life in this state when you send me home to wait for my baby to die inside of me and for me to wait for myself to get to a point where I have to gamble my uterus and gamble my life and gamble any future possibility of becoming pregnant. That's not pro-life. In a sense, it's almost pro-torture.
That news conference was held by the Center for Reproductive Rights, which brought the lawsuit on behalf of 13 patients and two doctors. If you can tell us, Tamara, what you think the Biden administration should be doing as state after state run by Republicans are cracking down or imposing almost complete abortion bans, what can the federal government do?
Yeah, I know that story all too well here in Kentucky. We have so many that are nearly identical as we face the same barriers here. And the federal government, you know, needs to do better by us. They need to protect us, protect Kentuckians, protect Americans seeking abortion care. We shouldn't be fleeing from our homes to access care that we should be able to get at home. You know, and now in Kentucky, you know, we're going to lose our second closest state for abortion care next Tuesday. You know, Indiana's going to go dark for abortion care on August 1st, and 90% of Kentuckians were going to Indiana this last year. And so we will have to go further away for care, and it puts more people in jeopardy, especially in emergent needs, where even in medical crisis, we have to leave our state. And so more needs to be done, because this is all too familiar a story for so many of us across the country.
Tamara Weider, we want to thank you for being with us, Kentucky State Director for Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates. Next up, we talk to a leading Kurdish-American activist who just walked from Washington, D.C. to the United Nations. Stay with us. by the Kurdish musician Yekbun. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with peace activist Kani Zulam, who's the director of the American Kurdish Information Network. He's just arrived in New York City after a solo 300-mile, 24-day walk from the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., to United Nations headquarters here. Monday marked the 100th anniversary of the partitioning of Kurdistan into four parts: British, Iraq, and French Syria, Turkey, and Iran. All of this was done without the consent of the Kurdish people. They were left without a recognized sovereign state. What's happened since has been called a cultural genocide. This comes as the Kurds of Syria face threats from all sides after devastating earthquakes and relentless attacks by the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Kani Zulam is joining us here in New York for more. Kani, welcome back to Democracy Now! The latest news of globally around Kurds was Sweden, in order to get into NATO, making a deal with the Turkish president, Erdogan, around what should happen to the Kurds there, who he so often calls terrorists, those who fled Turkey and now live in Sweden. Your response?
When NATO was conceived, it was supposed to be an alliance for freedom. And Kurds don't have freedom. On top of it, their language is banned. They're subjected to cultural genocide. If NATO wants to reassess its aims, its future aspirations, it needs to address this issue. It cannot cave in to Erdogan and his racist policies that are trying to eradicate the name of the Kurds from the geography of the Middle East.
And could you talk a little about the history, especially of this treaty 100 years ago that partitioned the Kurdish people into four different states?
You know, when the war started, and an imperialist war, when America entered it, at least President Wilson said he wants to make the world safe for democracy. What happened afterwards was anything but to make the world safe for democracy. British, France, they joined Turkey and Iran in basically partitioning the land of the Kurds through fraud, through force, without the consent of any of the Kurds on the ground. It was a deal done in Lausanne, in the heart of Europe, and we have been living with its effects. In Iraq, we have been gassed. In Syria, we have had three different laws applying to our citizenship rights. In Turkey, our very name has been eradicated from the land, if you will. Our mountains have acquired Turkish names. Our rivers have acquired Turkish names. Our villages have acquired Turkish names. And we have been struggling ever since to have a say. And I walked from Washington, D.C. to United Nations to say that we exist, we have a voice, we have a history, we have a culture, we are no different than our neighbors, and we need to solve this issue through a peaceful means, through civil discourse. In the heart of the Middle East, we have the presence of the Kurds. It's like, you know, the presence of Alps in Europe or the presence of Zagros Mountains in the Middle East. And it's an objective fact. And yet our neighbors are saying that there are no Kurds, and they're trying to pretend that the Kurds don't exist. And they're trying to assimilate every single Kurd on the ground as we speak.
Kani Zulam, in 1997, you were one of two Americans and four Kurds who fasted for peace in Kurdistan and for the freedom of Kurdish parliamentarians who've been arrested by Turkey and imprisoned. This is you speaking while fasting on the steps of Capitol Hill. Again, this is Washington, D.C., 1997.
Today, with some guarded optimism, we can report to you that our fast did have its intended effect on the policymakers in Washington. We also wanted to reach out to the mainstream media. Although the Washington Post and Chicago Tribune did pay some homage to our fast, much of the rest of the mainstream media kept their distance from us. They failed to validate our nonviolent message for peace and freedom. They did a disservice to our people's longing for peace and to their people's longing for the truth. It is unfortunate that Saddam and war sell better than Ferda and peace. Frankly, we are not disappointed. We are committed to our cause more than ever before.
So that was Connie Shulam in 1997. Connie, has there been progress made? And what do you think needs to happen now?
The progress has been slow. We are trying to make America Kurdish-friendly, D.C. Kurdish-friendly. I'm reminded of a quote by Dr. King, who said, the whites need the blacks to come clean, to get rid of their guilt. The blacks need the whites to heal, to lose their fear. The British, the French, the Turks, the Persians partitioned our homeland. They need to come clean, and they need to they need to reach out to us so that they could live in conscience, in good faith with their children. And we need them to help us lose our fear and lose our hurt, the pain and the suffering that has been inflicted on us for the last 100 years since the treaty. And the future is really, we have to respect the Kurds and accept the Kurds. They deserve a seat at the United Nations, too. To pretend that the Kurds don't exist is to pretend that the world is flat.
And Connie Shulam, could you talk about the role of the United States, for instance, during the invasion of Iraq and the Iraq War? The U.S. backed autonomy for the Kurds as a means of achieving its own, the White House's own goals in the Middle East, but of course has said nothing about the Kurds in Turkey or in the other Middle East states.
You know, in the course of my walk, long walk for freedom across the founding heartland of America, I came across a sign saying Americans who had died for the cause of Iraqi freedom. Many died, that's true. But the Kurds really didn't want to have anything to do with the Arab majority in Iraq. They desperately wanted to be on their own. In 2017, they voted to be on their own. And yet, neither the United Nations nor the U.S. honored them, in spite of their support of the Allied effort to topple Saddam. In Syria, 11,000 Kurds have died together with their Arab comrades to get rid of ISIS threat, not just in the Middle East, but also from Europe and in the world. The relationship between the United States and the Kurds in Syria is still a military one. The Kurds desperately want that relationship to be a political one. We need political status. We cannot depend on our neighbors who are bent on our destruction. This is a crime against humanity, and it needs to be stated, and I appreciate Democracy Now! For allowing me to say this on the air.
Connie Shulam, we want to thank you for being with us. Director of the American Kurdish Information Network has just completed a solo walk from Washington, D.C. To the United Nations. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for paid internships in our archive and development departments. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guster, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. If you want to see transcripts of our shows or video or audio podcasts or sign up for our daily news digest, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman in New York. Juan Gonzalez is in Chicago. Thanks so much for joining us.
On Sunday, July 30th, join the SFU Pipe Band from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. for a free concert at the Academic Quadrangle near the pond at the SFU Burnaby campus. Experience a morning of exhilarating pipe and drum music with the world-renowned band before they head to Scotland to compete at this year's World Pipe Band Championships in August. The concert will be held outdoors, so please dress for the weather and consider bringing a blanket or chair to sit on. Hope to see you there.
You're listening to